You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 7th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Kara, welcome back.
Yes,
hey, Kara.
Hey, I missed you guys.
Missed you.
Did I only miss 1 week or did I miss more than one?
I think you just missed one because we recorded two episodes.
Oh, yeah, because you were going to Hawaii and I was going to the Netherlands.
How was the Netherlands?
It was cold. But I ate a lot of stroopwafels.
Those are delicious.
Aren't they?
So sweet.
Love them. I know they're too sweet. I brought some home and I was like, that was a mistake.
How about Schweinsteiger? Did you have any of that?
No, what's that?
Oh!
Dang it! You guys always get me. What did you just say?
That's from Young Frankenstein.
How do you remember these movies? Didn't Young Frankenstein come out like when I was like 6 years old?
1977.
Yeah, oh, before I was born.
We would watch that movie every week.
You're such nerds.
Well, it's an exaggeration, but we saw it many times.
I mean, I saw that movie and I really liked it, but I could not quote it. I did not have any recognition that.
Yeah, because you didn't see it 40 times like we did
exactly.
Growing up.
Yeah, it's burned in.
You would have an enormous Schweinsteiger.
No, I ate many stroopwafel and I ate a lot of croquettes, which were very good.
Frau Blücher.
And I do miss Amsterdam, and I want to go back.
Yeah. Was it a good city?
It's a great city. I highly recommend it if you've never visited. I think the thing about the Dutch that is the most salient for me is that they're incredibly kind. It's just a very pleasant, very friendly place to be. Whether you're in the big city in Amsterdam, we went all over. So we went to a lot of small towns, and we spent a lot of time at Wageningen University, and the people there were really lovely and incredible, too. It's just a very pleasant, friendly place to be. And everyone speaks English, so it's a quite easy place to get around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some European countries, it's prioritized more than others. And I think that just almost everybody in the Netherlands learns English when they're quite young. It's kind of like
it's nice when people have the courtesy to learn American English.
You know? Well, that's
right.
The funny
speak
thing,
American.
Right? It's like, obviously, they don't speak American English. I mean, they just learn English. So I don't know.
They learn it correctly, is what you're saying.
They have Dutch accents, so it's hard to tell if they actually learned kind of an American version or a British version. But it is always fun for me when I travel the world a lot for work, and I'll be in like Hong Kong or I'll be in, I don't know, someplace random like Paris. And when you hear people speak English, you can almost tell who they learned it from based on their accent.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which
is
so cool. I love that.
Yeah, you can tell when somebody learned their English in the UK.
Exactly. Right? Or if they were in an international school and their teacher happened to be British, or they had a Canadian teacher, or they had, you know, an American teacher. And sometimes it's a weird amalgamation because what I hear a lot is that they learned most of their English watching American television.
Yeah, or if they learned it in a Turkish prison or something.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be a little different.
Oh, my gosh. Whoa, the movie references are just flying already.
Well, hey, let's get right into it because we have a lot of content for you this week. Kara, you're going to start us off with a What's the Word?
Yay. Hey, should I say this is a fun one this week?
It wouldn't be right.
It's an interesting one.
So it is interesting and fun. Actually, I like this one because I hate to admit it, but I didn't know this word before. So it was recommended by Adam Hepburn from Ontario. And he said he actually recommended a fun word and a not so fun word. So maybe we'll get to the not so fun word eventually. But today we're focusing on the fun one. And that word is analemma. Bob, you know this word.
Oh, yes.
Yes. It's
love
a good
it.
One. So, okay.
It's one of my favorite words.
It's a really cool, and it's a really cool, like, just concept. So, an analemma is a plot of the position of the sun in the sky if you were to go outside every day at the same time of day and make a mark. So you can do it different ways. You can do it from its shadow on the ground, or you can do it from actually taking a physical photo. If you go on the internet right now and you Google analemma, you see these stunning Google images.
Composites.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, of people who have taken these photos every day at the exact same time of day over the course of a year.
What we did in high school, which anybody could do, is you
– piece of paper in a
hole. You tape a piece of paper to the window and you put a pinhole in it.
Oh,
and
yeah,
then it
there
projects – an image on the far wall, and you know
mark the wall,
mark where that image falls at the same time every day, and you'll trace it out on a piece of paper.
Oh, I love
that. It's a low-tech way to do it.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to do it. They've obviously been doing this since antiquity, and it's it always makes the same pattern, which is sort of an elongated, figure eight.
Yeah.
In the northern hemisphere, it's bigger on the bottom than it is on the top. In the southern hemisphere, it is flipped. And the reason that it looks the way that it looks is because, number one, the Earth orbits the sun not in a perfect circle, but in an elliptical. And number two, the Earth is tilted. It's got an axial tilt of 23.4 degrees. And these two things combine to have an effect.
Like, and the third thing is that it's not flat.
The Earth. The Earth is not flat. It's true. As we learned once again this week from Elon Musk, which I think right we'll be getting to. So apparently if the Earth's orbital was elliptical but the Earth was not tilted on an axis, the analemma would be an oval. If the Earth were just tilted on its axis but there was no ellipsis, if it was an circular orbit, then the figure eight would be perfect.
Oh, cool.
Actually, to clarify, Kara, if the Earth's orbit were a perfect circle and not elliptical at all, the analemma would be a straight line. It wouldn't, there wouldn't be any back and forth at all, because that is due to the time differences throughout the year because of the eccentricity in the orbit. The line would be oriented in different angles depending on where you were on the Earth. You know, at the North Pole and South Pole, it'd be straight up and down. At the equator, it'd be horizontal, and it shifts everywhere in between.
Right. But because we're tilted, you get the smaller top, and that smaller top is related to, I think those are the summer months. That part of the path is, Bob, what's the word? Perihelion?
Perihelion.
Yeah. Perihelion. Okay. And that's when we're closer to the sun.
Yes.
And then the other side of the loop is at
aphelion,
and that's when we're further.
Here's how you remember perihelion. This is something I just thought up like decades ago. I'm like, how am I going to distinguish perihelion and aphelion? When I hear perihelion, I think of periscope. And what do you do to a periscope? You look real close to it, right? You put your eye right up to a periscope.
So that's its closer.
And that's the closest. And aphelion's the opposite. So that's worked for me for decades.
That's your mnemonic?
Yeah. So if you think about it, when the sun is closest, or I should say the Earth is closest to the sun, it's when it's moving faster around it, it causes the loop to be smaller. When we're farther from it and it's moving slower, it flattens out the loop. And so that's the really cool thing, is that people in the southern hemisphere actually have the broader loop at the top. If you were at the North Pole, you would only see the top loop of the analemma. And at the South Pole, you only see the bottom loop.
There's another cool thing about that, about the Earth sweeping out, you know, going faster at perihelion. But if you draw a triangle from the Earth at the beginning of a sweep and the end of a sweep to the sun, it sweeps out
– same area.
The same area per unit of time. So even though it goes faster,
cool.
It's wider. So it's the same area as when it's at the other end of the
that's
orbit.
That's Kepler's second law of planetary motion?
I love celestial geometry. It's so cool. Oh, and So it's, you know, it's going to be different depending on where you are on Earth. So if you look at those images, you're going to see differences based on the surroundings. So some kind of brilliant photographers will go out and take photograph in a really famous place where, you know, there will be ruins or something in the foreground so that you know where you are. And then, of course, if we were on any of the other planets, we would have a different shaped analemma. Because it's
depending on tilt and eccentricity.
Exactly. It's based on both of those things.
I want to see the analemmas from every planet. What would it be like?
Cool, right?
Has anyone ever done that?
I don't know.
Shouldn't be that hard to figure out. Cool.
Yeah, computer simulation should be able to do it, yeah.
Well, there's one on the globe of my Earth here in the office. I'll need other globes to see if
so there's an analemma
those.
On every globe.
There should
I
be.
I love it. Yeah.
Really?
Spin it around. It's usually like right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Because that's where you can
die. Because that's where there's all this empty space. It's super cool. So that's what you're looking at there. So analemma is a word that actually means the pedestal of a sundial. That was actually the Latin translation. And if you break it down further, it means to take up. So it's like holding something up. It used to refer to like a support, sort of like a prop that you could hold something up on.
Pedestal.
And, yeah, it meant the pedestal of the sundial, but really it was a synecdoche. So it was sort of like the word eventually referred to the whole sundial itself. Synecdoche. And that's where the analemma thing comes from, because it's a way to kind of measure where you are in the year. Synecdoche. And I love that the email that I got from Adam Hepburn said, if you track the sun in the sky at the same time of the day every year, the lopsided figure eight you get is an analemma. The first time I saw the pattern was in Castaway, when Tom Hanks' character draws one in the sand to track the months as he lived on the island.
That's right, he did.
Oh, yeah. What a good
idea. That was in the movie. I remember that.
So that's what that is. Very cool.
I like to, like, throughout the year, I like to imagine where we are on the analemma. You know what I mean?
I love
like,
that. Oh,
We're past the winter solstice, so we're coming up, you know, the other side of it. We're heading, the sun is rising up the analemma. Then when we get past the spring equinox, then we cross over, right? Then we're in the upper half. And I know it's always nice to be in the upper half of the analemma.
Me too.
Oh, yeah. Days are nice and long. Yeah, that's summer. Great. And the sun is really high.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Of course.
So, Jay, we recently had a launch of the Falcon Heavy, or as they call it in the UK, the Falcon Heavy.
Yeah. Oh my God. Talk about exciting. I was one of those people. I was at lunch when it was supposed to launch, and then they delayed it, and I was psyched because it was delayed. Anyway, so SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket did successfully launch at the Kennedy Space Center this week at 3:45 p.m. This was on February 6th, 2018. So the delay that I mentioned, that was due to high winds in the upper atmosphere. And they just kept delaying it to wait till the speed of those winds subsided enough where they didn't think that the Falcon was going to be in any trouble. Just, you know, a few points of interest here. The rocket has 27 engines. They can generate more thrust than 18 747 jumbo jets. You know, keeping in mind that each one of those jumbo jets has four engines on them themselves, and those engines are, you know, very, very powerful. This was a test launch. That's why Elon decided, hey, we got to send up some cargo just to show that it can send up cargo, right? You know, you want to send it up with nothing in it. You want to send it up with some type of payload. So he tweeted at one point that it's probably going to explode on launch, which I just love his honest attitude. You know, like, it's a test. We don't know. It hasn't been fully tested. We're obviously not going to be putting people on the very first launch. But it was largely a success, but it wasn't 100%. Success. I don't know if you guys know some of these details here. So the two outer cores, or the outer rockets that you see, right? Because when you see
boosters.
The rocket, yeah, you know, it's funny. They're really not calling them boosters. They're calling them cores or cores. Yeah, that's space lingo, Bob. So these two engines, you know, one on the left and one on the right hand side of the Falcon, they did go up, detach, and retro rocket with beautiful accuracy, almost 100% exactly landing on time. They were like a second apart from each other. They really, you know, landed themselves vertically like you've seen, and beautiful, and everything was great.
Still blows me away.
Yeah.
It looked like something out of a science fiction movie.
That just blew me away.
Watch those two things landing in tandem, and it's emotional. It's like amazing to watch that happen.
Can I ask, because I know nothing about this topic. This is all very, like, you know, aeronautical engineering, orbital mechanics, all these things are like always a little Greek to me. Why is this the first time something like that's ever been done? Like, why didn't NASA ever land their boosters?
I'll tell you why. I mean, look, there's going to be people that listen to this show that know the answer much better than me. But it was actually a pretty novel idea for SpaceX to say, we want to reuse components. NASA always just built them for one launch, and they didn't reuse components. I mean, the space
except shuttle, for the shuttle itself.
Yeah, of course. I was just getting there. The space shuttle was really the first reusable craft that they built. You know, I think Elon was thinking, you know, we want the space industry to be like the aviation industry. You don't throw away a plane after every time it flies, or, you know, you use it for a decade. You could use it for many, many, many trips.
There's cost savings.
Yeah, it's so expensive.
Yeah, but
yeah, $10,000 to get a pound into orbit. I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah. So anything, any way you could save money, do it. They got it.
Yeah, Kara, it's also like asking, how come we just now have self-driving cars? Well, we needed the computer technology and somebody needed to develop the algorithm. I mean, SpaceX crashed a lot of rocket boosters before they figured out how to make it work.
Yeah, so these, you know, they're very likely going to be reusing the those outer cores. Now, the inner core, now this is the core of the very center of the spacecraft, the rocket in the middle, right? That one came down, but only one of the three engines ignited on re-entry, which means that it hit the Atlantic Ocean at 300 miles per hour.
Oh,
and it was fast. It was turned into shrapnel at that point. And it missed the barge, the landing barge, I think by about 300 feet. So it was very close. Which I find to be very interesting, but it couldn't slow down enough to survive the
crash.
So
what happened?
Yeah, did they send a cleanup?
Yeah, I'm sure that they do as best a job as they can, but you know, things are sinking. You know, it's in the ocean.
What was sinking?
what went wrong, Jay? Do they know yet what went wrong?
I scoured the internet. I could not find anything, and it was really weird, but Elon didn't return my phone calls. I don't know what's up with him.
Bastard.
So bottom line is, that it's okay, right? This is the new way we think about things when it comes to SpaceX. It's okay. They don't care about the failure. They just want to fix the problem. They're learning from all these mistakes. And that's why they tested it, you know? I don't think anyone thought that it was likely that there was going to be something catastrophic happening, but it did much, much better overall than they were predicting even a few months ago. So the upper stage of the rocket was, of course, carrying Elon Musk's Midnight Cherry Red Tesla Roadster. I have a lot to say about this, but I just want to get through some of the cool facts about it, then we'll get into the romance of it. So the rocket's engine ignited without a problem and raised the car into orbit with ease. It was a very cool thing that the rocket went through the radiation belt, right? Did you guys hear about this fact? This is really cool.
The Van Allen belt.
Yeah. So this is a radiation belt that surrounds the Earth, and it's called the Van Allen belts. Thank you, Evan. And the rocket and the car were hit with high energy particles to prove to the U.S. Air Force that the rocket can withstand that level of radiation and then continue to work. So for most people, they just saw cool live streaming footage of the car going around the Earth. My God, was that gorgeous. But there was a real meaningful reason for them to do it, and it succeeded, you know, because the rocket is still functioning perfectly. So once that maneuver was completed, the engine burned again, which it was supposed to, but it burned too long, and it now is no longer going to be able to go in orbit around Mars.
It was going to orbit Mars.
What?
Huh?
Yep.
Yeah, or go outside of our, right, around.
Okay, I'm confused. One more time, like, because I keep reading Mars Earth elliptical.
Yeah.
What does that
mean?
Yeah,
it wasn't. They were not really optimistic about it. I don't think it wasn't on a Mars insertion orbit, right? It wasn't going to get it into orbit around Mars. They just wanted to get it to Mars's orbit.
Yeah.
You know? What is that? I don't understand the difference.
That's, well, in other words, Mars's orbit around the sun. They want to so that it's orbiting the sun in the same orbit that Mars is orbiting the sun.
So then why did they call it a Mars Earth elliptical? I feel like
because it's an elliptical that will take you from the Earth to Mars.
Yeah. Oh, so it's an Earth Mars elliptical.
Yeah, yeah. But they overshot and now it's going to end up in the asteroid
belt
instead. So the Roadster is going to be the first belter.
Yep. And this, guys.
Nice.
Orbital mechanics are so complicated that they're still figuring out where the car is going to go.
What are the odds of the car successfully navigating the asteroid belt?
No, really? Like, how much is it going to get super smashed up? Are there cameras on it? Are we going to be able to watch this car for, like, all of eternity?
I hope so.
As long as the battery's in the camera.
Yeah, who knows?
How long are the batteries good for?
I don't know. And I also don't know if there's solar panels on there or not. I'd be surprised. But we're going to have
Tesla. It should have solar panels.
It is going to be broadcasting music. You know, it is broadcasting some music. Let me keep going here, guys. So SpaceX is taking their time to calculate exactly where the car is going to go, like I said. And overall, the Falcon Heavy rocket proved, though, that it can easily deploy very heavy payloads to deep space, not just to low Earth orbit, but to deep space. Now, it has more than 5 million pounds of thrust, and it can put over 140,000 pounds of payload into low Earth orbit. And that's double what any other rocket that's flying today can carry. It's the most powerful rocket since the Saturn V. So the Saturn V liftoff thrust was 7.6 million pounds, or 3.5 4 million kilograms, and the Falcon Heavy can do 5 million pounds or 2.2 million kilograms. So this is a very seriously powerful rocket. Now, the dummy that they put in the driver's seat of the car is called Starman, and of course that's referencing the David Bowie song. Now, seeing an image of the Starman sitting in the car in orbit around the Earth, really, it blew my mind.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Know what that reminds me of?
What?
The movie Heavy Metal.
Of course.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Without a doubt. Now, SpaceX.
Actually, the live stream ended. I was up for 4.5 hours. So now you just watch that 4.5 hour loop if you want to.
Now, Elon could have picked a hunk of metal. He could have just said, we're going to put this, you know, square block of whatever the cheapest metal on Earth is up into space. But he's like, no, you know, I'm going to put my car up there. And look, he thought about it. And he picked it for some obvious reasons. The car, first, it represents modern technology. It represents something that's very important to him. I think there was a very personal attachment to this idea, is putting his car up there. But it also gives us this romantic vision of something something utterly unique being put into outer space that, in a way, somehow seems like it belongs there, even though a car has no business being in outer space. It looked so cool. It was such a beautiful color, the color red versus the rich blue color of the Earth from outer space behind it. It was gorgeous.
With the dummy in the driver's seat. Yeah. It's incredible.
Exactly. Now,
you needed that human being. Yeah.
Yeah, because you can envision yourself in seat, in that environment. You put yourself there as well.
It's stunning. It's just it's so bizarre, too. It's just something we've never seen before.
Well, NASA,
he should have put a skeleton in the spacesuit.
The real reason why he sent the car up is he has a dead body in a trunk.
That's like the best possible.
And of course, guys, now, what was the icing on the cake, guys? Come on, tell me the
dashboard.
Things.
The dashboard.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jay. Tell us
what you panic.
Yeah, he wrote "Don't Panic" where the navigation system would show up on the dashboard. And the reason why is Elon was and still is an incredibly huge fan of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Of course.
And, you know, because of the name of our show, I got a little extra kick out of that. Like, I just felt like a little piece of us were up there. We're huge fans of The Hitchhiker's Guide as well.
As you can tell from the name of our podcast.
Not just a coincidence.
Did you see the Sam Harris Elon Musk Twitter exchange?
No.
It's so good. So right after, Sam Harris retweeted the SpaceX tweet that just says liftoff and has a beautiful image. So he retweeted it and he wrote, "That was one of the coolest things our species has ever done. Congratulations to Elon Musk and the rest of the SpaceX team." And then Elon replied to him and said, "We're doing okay for a bunch of monkeys. Humanity rocks."
It is. It's a dose of success in science and the romantic vision of science we needed so much. You know, Elon is also hoping here that this is going to launch. This launch will further encourage other companies, right? You know that there's a few other heavy hitters that are developing rocket technology, like the guy that owns Amazon. He wants to encourage these other companies to continue to build their own rocket systems. They are building them. Elon was congratulated by a couple of his contemporaries that are, you know, doing the same thing that he's doing. Now, ultimately, Elon wants another space race, but this time to benefit humanity and not be for military reasons.
Yeah. And I think that he's going to inspire, like, Elon single-handedly is inspiring a new generation of engineers and scientists.
He captured me. He really captured me. I remember what it felt like being I just was always into the space programs. My dad was a huge, you know, reason for that, just talking about it. And I had a lot of toys that had to do with space. And I just was always fascinated by anything to do with outer space exploration and the moon missions and everything.
Yeah. So imagine being like a 12-year-old boy or girl and watching what just happened.
Yep.
Your moon landing.
I like to think of things in terms like this. That launch that just took place, it changed humanity, and it made some kids, some little boys and girls out there are going to become scientists and at the very least be fans of science because of the launch of that one spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. They may live on Mars because of that launch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Sure.
And do you guys know what music is playing perpetually in the background?
Yeah.
Is it not Starman?
No.
Space Oddity.
Ground control to Major Tom.
I have one more thing that I found that Elon said. It was really cool. He just said the Falcon Heavy doesn't need to use gravity assist. It could do whatever you want it to do. Like, it's a super versatile piece of machinery. He said that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't need to be refueled. It doesn't, it could take you anywhere you want to go in the solar system. And that, my God, God, that is so awesome that we have it right now. And that, you know, he's already,
I don't know about that.
It could take you to Pluto, Bob, right from the Earth without gravity assist. Yes, that's what he said.
With no gravity assist.
Yeah.
I got to, I want to check up on
skeptical.
That one. Yeah, I want to check on that.
Mm. Go ahead. Jackass. Anyway.
It's good to be skeptical, Jay.
So, hey, I just massive respect to all the people at SpaceX and to Elon for doing this. I mean, you know, Elon is humble and he thanks his engineers and says, you know, congratulates them for doing astounding work. But everybody, God, I'm so happy that this happened now. It's a great time. I have a 5-year-old son. You know, I'm talking to him about it. It's giving us a lot of things to discuss. He's asking me a lot of questions about outer space, and it's just a wonderful thing. We need this kind of stuff, especially in the current political environment that we're in, where so much science is being squashed. I almost said squience. So much. I should have said it.
I'm writing that down. This is the phenomenon of science being squashed.
It's called squience.
Squience.
With so much squience happening, we needed this. Thank you, Elon.
Very nice. It's a good milestone. Good milestone. Just looking forward to more to come. All right, Evan, you're going to bring it down to earth a little bit and tell us about Egyptian dinosaurs.
Ooh. Yeah, I know. This one's a good article, too, because when we talk about places on the earth which are known for dinosaur fossil discoveries, you might think about China or
China for birds.
China for birds.
Feathered dinosaurs.
The northern and northwestern plains of the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. The Badlands.
For T-Rex.
The Badlands, And even places like Argentina and other parts of South
America.
For
big sauropods.
Yeah, for the long necks. Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is that dinosaur remains actually can be found on all of the continents. Yes, including Antarctica. Those are not as easy or convenient to find, but they do exist. And they're much older. And definitely on the continent of Zealandia. I just wanted to get Zealandia. It's not officially a continent, but it gets my vote. So when you spin your globe and have a look around, you might find an analemma, as Kara was talking about earlier. And when it comes to a place like Egypt, so it instantly evokes images in your head of things like what? The pyramids, the Sphinx, the Nile River, sand-filled deserts, okay? Your brain doesn't exactly think about dinosaurs or the potential for significant dinosaur fossil discoveries. However, on January 29th, an article was published in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution. It was authored by a team of paleontologists, biologists, and earth scientists from Egypt and America who have unearthed and identified new dinosaur fossil remains in Egypt's western desert. And as if the fact that paleontology in Egypt isn't a cool enough idea on its own, this particular find has a highly significant value. The fossil remains are those of a newly identified titanosaurian sauropod dinosaur.
Whoa.
Called Mansorosaurus.
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 That's such a weird name.
Shahinye. And this find has provided the first unambiguous evidence for a post-Cenomanian Cretaceous continental vertebrate clade that inhabited both Africa and Europe. And I took that right out of the abstract, by the way. Now, what that means is that for the first time on the continent of Africa, a titanosaur, which lived in the range of 65 million to 95 million years ago, that's the late Cretaceous period, has been verified. Terrestrial vertebrates from the final 30 million years of the Mesozoic are extremely rare and fragmentary on continental Africa, as they explain also in the abstract. And one of the chief reasons that they're rare is that, especially in areas like this, there's no rocky strata essentially to assist in the preserving of the fossil bed remains. So this is kind of an outlier in that regard. You don't have that protection in that particular environment, but regardless, they found it. And they've been looking for a long, long time for this.
Because there's been a ton of other fossils in Africa, like in North Africa especially. That's where like almost all trilobites come from.
It all depends on what your window is, Kara, right? It's like the available strata that we can get access to how preserved is it, and how and what is it date to?
Yeah, you know, and those are obviously way older, like much, much older. Because yeah, there's a lot of like orthoceras, there's a lot of trilobites, there's a lot of ammonites, but these things are much older than dinosaurs. I mean, they existed for a long time after, but they're, you know, Cambrian explosion kinds of things.
But apparently not a dinosaur of this size or from this particular age. This is the first time. Now, they did not get a mostly intact specimen. It's parts of its skeleton, but it did include cranial elements, and there were enough pieces of the puzzle to put it together and declare the find Manosaurosaurus. Cool. And so, SGU listeners, if you'll indulge me, allow me to officially introduce you to our newly discovered friend, Mansorosaurus shahine. Here I go. Hi, my name is Mansorosaurus. I'm a dinosaur, and a titanosaur at that. My height is around 9 to 10 meters at the shoulder, and I weigh in at a Rubenesque 5,000 kilograms.
Rubenesque.
For the benefit of the listeners at home, I like describing myself as being around the size of a city bus with an alarmingly long neck, so picture that. Until recently, I lived in the sands of Western Egypt, but I really have no idea where I am at this particular moment in time. I don't like talking about my age, but I'm in the range of between 65 million and 95 million years old, and I do have a birthday coming up, so check out my online registry for gift suggestions. I'm an herbivore, but I'm not judgmental of others, so go ahead and eat whatever pleases you. I'm also a holotype, meaning that there's only one of me discovered so far, but I'm hoping that some others will be discovered in coming years that I can be with other collections of minerals the same as me. Hope to see you at the Peabody Museum someday, Stephen Novella. And folks, that's my version of the dating game. Get it? The dating game?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very nice. Nice.
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
But that's not going to live at the Peabody. That's where the bones are going to be. Somewhere else.
Look at the bones.
I get that, Steve, but I had to tie you in somehow.
Yeah, I understand.
To this, so.
But we have to be pedantic, right?
Pedantic.
Right.
Thank you, Evan.
Yeah, but and the key is just to emphasize the key bit is that this is the first evidence of a clade that was in both Europe and what is now Europe and now Africa at the same time, indicating that the Northern African dinosaurs weren't all isolated clades. They actually were intermixing. So, which makes sense because, you know, they were all one continent at one point. There probably was a land bridge at the time that this dinosaur was roaming around.
Yep, makes sense. And it's opening up new and exciting possibilities for further excavations and discoveries in that region of Africa. So good stuff.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
Learning should be a lifelong thing. It doesn't end when you're out of school. And the Great Courses Plus is one of the best ways to do that. You can download college courses, entire college courses from experts who know their stuff. And you could learn whatever you're passionate about, from astronomy to physics to even cameras. Anything. They've got so many topics. What else do they have? They've got cooking. Whatever you're interested in, you will learn cutting edge information about that topic. And it's such a great way to spend time when you're driving or doing mindless work. You could pretty much get the equivalent of a degree just by listening to these amazingly smart people teach you stuff.
So we've been watching the course, What Einstein Got Wrong. It's a really interesting way to approach this topic because obviously Einstein made tremendous contributions to concepts like space-time, gravity, energy, matter, that whole relativity thing. But obviously, there were limits to his ability to understand the universe, and knowing where he went to the end and what he then got wrong is a fascinating way to learn about what we now know about physics that goes even beyond Einstein. Really interesting approach.
And guys, if you're interested in learning more about Einstein, you can watch these courses from any TV, laptop, tablet, or smartphone. Or my favorite is that you can listen along with the Great Courses Plus app.
As one of our listeners, you're going to get a free trial to enjoy it all, but you need to go to our special URL. Start your free trial today. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Bob, this would have been a great science or fiction if you didn't catch it first.
Come on, you can't miss this.
The first extragalactic planet.
Yes. So hold on to your hats. This is a cool one. Scientists have indirectly found exoplanets in another galaxy, and not a close galaxy. This one's almost, wait for it, 4 billion light years away. Is that worth a holy crap or what?
A third of the universe away, roughly?
Man. So this was announced in Probing Planets and Extragalactic Galaxies using quasar microlensing, which recently appeared in the astrophysical journal Letters. And the research was done by Xinyu Dai and Eduardo Guerras, a postdoctoral researcher and professor, respectively, at University of Oklahoma. So how is this even possible without a TARDIS or something? Well, as of recently, yes, I've been watching lots of Doctor Who lately. Yes, well, as recently as early December, we detected over like 3,710 planets in 2,780 star systems, and 620 one of them have been have had multiple planets. So we actually have multiple methods of detecting exoplanets. We've covered them on the show, and I, of course, will go over that again really quickly. We have direct imaging. You could actually, in some rare circumstances, directly image an exoplanet. It could be the reflected light or the infrared signature, but that's typically – it's got to be pretty close, or if the circumstances are perfect, you can go out even more than, you know, I think they imaged one at 200 light years. Then you've got the radial velocity method, which basically, you can actually sense the tug on the star, the push and pull based on the planets orbiting it. Then there's a transit method, which we've probably talked about most often. And the transit method just senses the dip in the output of the light from the star based on the planets crossing it. And that could reach out hundreds of light years. I didn't mention the radial velocity is good for like up to 100 light years or so. And then you've got another method, which I wasn't too familiar with, called microlensing. And that could go out thousands of light years or apparently billions of light years. And microlensing, of course, is exactly how this latest amazing feat was accomplished. So what the hell is that? So, all right, to understand microlensing, you got to understand just general gravitational lensing, which we have talked about on the show many times. It's very basically a massive foreground object like a galaxy cluster warps space and therefore bends the light like a lens from a more distant object like a galaxy. And this magnification gives us a much closer look. It just really brightens it up. It's like we're a lot closer than we actually are. So it's an amazing opportunity. It's such a gorgeous phenomenon predicted by Einstein, of course. And it could also produce other things, other manifestations like beautiful Einstein rings, or it could even reveal the effect of the mass underlying what would otherwise be invisible dark matter and others. So now microlensing is based on that whole idea of gravitational lensing. So it can be employed to use a closer star. So imagine you've got a closer star, and you're using that to magnify a more distant star right behind it from our point of view. And from there, we could then use the transit method or even the radial velocity method to infer planets around that more distant star that has now been magnified for us. We've already found about 50 exoplanets in the Milky Way using that method, thousands of light years away, far beyond what the other methods can do on their own. I think the most distant exoplanet in our galaxy was 13,000 light years away, very far away, until, of course, you listen to this news item. It's like, well, wow. So the method they used was specifically called quasar microlensing to detect these planets billions of light years away. The specific technique they used was not surprisingly, it's difficult to figure out based on the news write-ups. I was very disappointed. And eventually I had to hunt down the original paper, which I finally was able to get without paying. And I read the original paper and I was like, okay, now I get this. Because microlensing is one thing, but what they did was a little bit different. And quasar microlensing was kind of a different twist on the whole idea of microlensing. So try to imagine this. You've got a distant quasar. Okay, which is basically just a distant galaxy that's got a very active galactic core, very active black hole at its center, probably a supermassive black hole. Okay, so then this is being lensed by a closer galaxy. So you got the Earth, you've got a close by galaxy, relatively speaking, and you've got this distant quasar. So the light leaves the quasar and crosses different areas of that foreground galaxy. You know, it goes through the right part, the middle part, the top part. So it's going through different areas of that galaxy. And that light is also coming towards the Earth, and it's being lensed by stars that are closer to us, like in our galaxy. So you've got lots of lensing opportunities happening with this quasar. Using that technique, they could actually take a really close look at the quasar's accretion disk swirling around the supermassive black hole that's there. So imagine that. You've got this quasar that's being magnified using micro lensing, and you could get a close look at the actual accretion disk of matter that's swirling around the black hole before it's being sucked in, gone forever. So the paper then says this: as we probe smaller and smaller emission regions of the accretion disk close to the event horizon of the supermassive black hole, the gravitational fields of the planets in the lensing galaxy start to contribute to the overall gravitational lensing effect, providing us with an opportunity to probe planets in extragalactic galaxies. Okay, so that's kind of the key sentence right there. So that means that they're probing such tiny regions of the accretion disk in the quasar that thousands of unbound planets in the closer lensing galaxy actually are modifying the lensing effect. Can you see that? So they were able to indirectly infer all of the 2,000 planets in this galaxy that's over 3.6 billion light years away.
But Bob, to clarify, that's not the total number of rogue planets in that galaxy. That's just the ones that they were able to see the effect of.
Right, right.
You know, I read they estimated there are trillions of rogue planets.
I heard the number trillion thrown around. But they're claiming that they indirectly detected about 2,000 of them. But yeah, if you extrapolate, to the entire quasar, then you could say that. And we know from what we've talked about on the show that there are countless rogue planets, maybe more rogue planets than planets that are bound to stars. It's an amazing number and something that you're just not, I think, science fiction has yet to mine well at all. Imagine you could conceivably have life on a rogue planet that's not bound to any star because you've got the radioactive release of heat and oceans never fully freeze. Even when if the Earth was ejected from the sun, our ocean would probably never fully freeze for maybe millions of years, if ever. So you could potentially have some fantastic sci-fi scenarios with these rogue planets, and they are all over the place, all over. So it's just amazing. So let me give you a quote from Eduardo Guedas here. He's like, this is an example of how powerful the techniques of analysis of extragalactic microlensing can be. This galaxy is located 3.8 billion light years away, and there's not the slightest chance of observing these planets directly, not even with the best telescopes one can imagine in a science fiction scenario. However, we are able to study them, unveil their presence, and even have an idea of their masses. This is very cool science. So yeah, I have to say, though, that I think his imagination is lacking if he thinks even science fiction couldn't make a telescope big enough to do this. So I just off the top of my head, how about harvesting an entire solar system to create an interferometer a light year across? And I'm just barely even breaking a sweat here. But yeah, I'm just wondering. I mean, I actually looked at some equations to try to determine what it would actually require. What kind of lens would you need to actually resolve, a planet from 3.8 billion years away? And I suspect you may need a lens bigger than that. We may need to take advantage of time and relative dimension in space, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Do you?
Who knows? Kara, what does he mean?
I don't know.
I guarantee Steve knows.
Yeah, that's the acronym for the TARDIS.
Oh, Jesus.
So yeah, that's a geeky little aside. But this is really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. But yeah, but just imagine if I said that astronomers have inferred the existence of exoplanets in a galaxy 3.8 billion years away and you hadn't read that article. That would have been...
Yeah, that I'd have to really think hard about that.
I wonder,
science fiction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It right. made big news, though.
Kara, why do people believe fake news?
Mm. Oh, wow. Mm. We got a lot of good topics this week.
This podcast is only 80 minutes long.
I know, right? This one's interesting. It's a new study that was published in Intelligence just this month. Fake news, incorrect but hard to correct. The role of cognitive ability on the impact of false information on social impressions. So from that title, what do you guys think? What do you think is the correlation between cognitive ability and the vulnerability to fake news?
I mean, the assumption would be that the more cognitively impaired you are, the more vulnerable you are would be my guess.
And it does seem to be the outcome of this study. So let me just kind of describe the design of this study. They looked at like nearly 400 people, 390 people, and that's the number they came upon when they did their initial power calculations to, you know, that would give them the kind of medium level of power that they would need for this study. And they went ahead and they gave 390 people, they split them into two different conditions. They split them into a control group and an experimental group, and they previously measured all of their cognitive ability. Now, it's a pretty simplified way to measure cognitive ability. They used a standard test that everybody in psychological assessment uses called the WAIS, which is the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale. It's kind of like it's sort of one of the standards for IQ testing, but they only took one of the subtests out of it. They did the vocabulary subtest, and they only used 10 items on it. So it's a very simplified version of cognitive ability. It's definitely not what we would call full-scale IQ. So keep that in mind. They didn't know the IQ of these people. They knew how well they did on a vocabulary test. So they get that information first, and then they split the two they split all of the different subjects into two groups. And what they did is they showed them kind of a fake scenario of a person named Natalie. I think I'm pronouncing that right. It was like Natalie with a TH, because this was in Belgium. Natalie. And they, in some of the groups, they showed them Natalie and they said, you know, I don't know what they said. Basically, here's Natalie. How do you feel about her? And they rated them on these different things, like how much do you trust her? They would have them on like dimensions. They would slide a slider from 0 to 100. Like, do you feel negatively or positively towards her? Cold versus warm, hostile versus friendly, unfavorable versus favorable. And then they also did untrustworthy versus trustworthy, insincere versus sincere, contemptuous versus respectful, and unintelligent versus intelligent. So some of them were told nothing. The other ones, though, were told that Natalie was arrested for stealing and dealing drugs to fuel her shopping habit. So obviously those people rated her very, very low. But then they came back and they said, oh, that was actually false. That information that we told you about Natalie wasn't true. Now go ahead and re-rate Natalie. And they did. And so the outcomes are interesting for multiple reasons. So first and foremost, the people in the low and the high cognitive ability group originally rated her, like in the control group, I'm sorry, rated her high. So if, remember I told you it was a slider from 0 to 100? So yeah. Their scores were like averaging around 80, which I'm kind of like, okay, why didn't you like her? Like, why did you 20% not like her? But maybe that's just like, oh, I don't know her. I'm going to give her an 80. Across the board, they were sort of averaging out there. In the groups that were told that Natalie was a thief and a drug addict, their ratings were around like 25. And there was no significant difference between the low cognitive ability and the high cognitive ability group. And by the way, they define these groups as either being one standard deviation below normal or one standard deviation above normal on a cognitive ability test. So remember I told you it was only a 10-item test, so I'm not sure if they use standard scores, but if it were like a full-scale IQ, that would mean a cognitive ability of 85 versus a cognitive ability of 115, if you know anything about IQ tests. That's sort of like the standard there. Anyway, so they compared the two of them. No significant difference, but it was super low. Like across the board, they rated her around a 25. Like, we don't like her. She's a drug addict and a thief. Then when they corrected the information, both groups changed their opinion. And this is what doesn't really come through very well in the write-arounds. Both groups really changed their opinions. It's just that there was a significant difference between the two groups. So the high cognitive ability people gave her a more favorable view after the information was corrected, the negative information. And they actually gave her a favorable view that was higher than the control group. Not much, but around like 85. The low cognitive ability group adjusted it up to, it looks like, I'm just looking at the graph of the data. I'm not actually looking at the raw data. It looks like it's around like 78 on average. So it's still way better. They went from like a 25 rating up to like a 78 rating. The thing is, there's a significant difference statistically between the low cognitive ability group and the high cognitive ability group on their post ratings of Nathalie.
Yeah, but that's a small effect size.
I mean, they reached in psychology, it's a moderate effect size. So it's like supposed to be a cutoff of like, this is what you need to, you know, this is the power of your thing. But you're right. It's significant. But it's not really that big of a change. So, yes, I do think that this study supports what we already thought, which is that, like, people who have a higher intellectual capacity or cognitive ability can probably adjust their opinions about things based on new information in a more strategic way. But also, think about all the confounds here. High cognitive ability is also highly correlated with education.
Yeah.
So it could be a function of learning. You know, they actually point out in a lot of the write-arounds this idea of metacognition, which we talk about on the show. I don't know if we use that term very often, but metacognition, thinking about thinking. How do you adjust your thoughts based on new evidence? This is a skill we learn often in like higher level secondary school and definitely in college and graduate school. So if you have an advanced education, hopefully you've learned how to think about thinking. One thing I should point out is they did adjust for two things. And this could be why the effect size is a little bit smaller, but they adjusted for openness, which is a personality trait. It's a measurable personality trait. And they also adjusted for what they called right-wing authoritarianism, which is sort of just whether or not you kind of, you know, negatively judge other people harshly, like pretty regularly. So this was after they adjusted for both of those things in the people that they tested. So that could have actually lowered it a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. I think that the effect, you're right, Steve, is not nearly as like, wow, dramatic.
Yeah, the signal to noise is small.
Exactly, it's small. And it's actually more impressive statistically, but
yeah, it's more impressive that both groups actually largely corrected the fake information.
And so this, I think, also kind of shows sometimes that the lab studies that we do maybe don't do the best job of replicating reality. Yeah. Because this is a simple study. It was like, okay, we showed you this girl. We told you a bunch of negative stuff about her. And then like right afterward, we were like, oh yeah, we were lying. She's actually awesome. Yeah. How do you rate her? Like, sure. I think that most people are going to be like, oh, just kidding. JK, JK, I think she's cool. But some people don't, or they don't do it as much. And that's an important point. And also, there's so many other factors involved when it comes to fake news. But I think the point of the study was to see, hey, just because we've corrected something, do people continue to hold those negative opinions? And even though by and large they don't, there's still an effect there. It's small.
Yeah, but that
there
could be a little bit of an anchoring effect.
Could be. That's yeah. It. Yeah, you know? Absolutely. So it's I don't know. It's interesting. It obviously does not account for all of the variance in the population. This is not the main reason. It's definitely not the only reason, and it's likely not the main reason that people consistently believe fake news. The Scientific American write-around of it, I think, did a good job of bringing in other studies and talking about some other findings that we've had recently. One of them is this idea of just like, what do they call it? The illusion of truth effect, where just if you repeat a false claim over and over and over and over, you're more likely to believe it.
Yeah, we interpret familiarity with veracity.
With veracity.
Oh, I've heard that. It must be true. Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense because that is how a lot of people determine what's true and what's not. And it's not a terrible cognitive strategy as a basic schema. The more something is, you know, discussed.
Except that it is. I mean, it's a heuristic. It may make a little bit of sense when you think about it.
That's what I'm saying.
It.
Yeah, that's why
but
I said
in the
it's a
real
basic
world,
schema.
In the real world, all it means is that you're going to believe the common nonsense.
And exactly.
It probably doesn't predict veracity at all when you think about it.
But as a life schema, it's been adaptive. It's why people use it. But you're right. As we get to the place where we're not concerned anymore about being adaptive and we're concerned about being intellectually honest, we're concerned about being good skeptics, we have to fight against those kinds of biases. Yeah. But yeah, that one makes obviously a lot of sense. They go through the 2015 study that really kind of supports that this is a real thing where people would – like they would know something And then if something that contradicts that thing that they know was repeated enough times, they would suddenly know the new thing, even though it was contradictory to actual known knowledge that they previously existed. So right. You do see that a lot. That's really important. And then at the end, you know, of this Scientific American ride around, they say the same thing that everybody says, which is like, you should be your own fact checker. And if you think something's true, ask yourself why. But it's hard, right? It's hard to, as we always talk about, to question something that is like in the positive. Yeah. It's like if you're going through life and everything is like, this is just how it is. It's just how it is. You're like, okay, sure. That's just how it is. It's a little bit different when you come across something that's novel, because then you're like, wait, that seems wrong to me. I need to investigate whether or not that's true. But if something doesn't feel novel, if it feels repeated constantly, if you're constantly seeing it in your news feed because the algorithms are feeding you what they know you want to be reading, it's not as easy to stop and say, oh, is this true?
Yeah, that's the problem with narratives and propaganda and echo chambers, is that they sort of whittle away over time until it gets to the point where it's just in the background. You know, at some point you just accept it as part of reality. You know, it's just, you take it for granted. You stop questioning it. It doesn't trigger anything in you because you just know it as a truthiness that's part of the background.
Yes.
You know?
And to me, that's like the interesting thing that I got out of reading about this. I didn't get out of it, oh, there's like a really important, like, actually the headline of the SIAM article is really misleading. It says cognitive ability and vulnerability to fake news. Researchers identify a major risk factor for pernicious effect on misinformation. Yeah. And I'm like, no, they didn't. They identified a minor risk factor.
Minor, I would say minor and dubious.
And dubious.
Given the replicability of this kind of research, when you see a small effect size like that, I wouldn't bet on it.
And so the thing is, like, yes, maybe a significant difference in cognitive ability is correlated, I have to say, with a slightly worse ability to rebound after fake news is corrected. But there's so much more to the equation.
Okay, Jay, give us a Who's That Noisy?
Whoa. Okay, last week I played this noisy.
I still think it's a singing frog.
Or a parrot.
It's a marine animal. They all sing.
Yeah, but do they sing Gente Alouette?
The French ones do.
Good point.
Bob?
The first sound recording ever.
Don't think so, but...
I'll just go. I'll get right to it. This guy got a notable mention. Eric Harris said, finally listening to this week's SGU, maybe it's just because you primed us by talking about bird sounds, but the song sounded to me just like a parrot singing. And he had a guess, and he said African gray, and that is not correct, but he was correct. It was a parrot.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
The winner from last week is Lisa Marie, and Lisa said, that sounds like an Amazon parrot to me. So Lisa basically guessed the closest. That is actually a yellow-naped Amazon parrot named Groucho, and Groucho works for Disney in their animal kingdom. And Groucho can do a lot of talking, and that is an example of the quality of talking that Groucho can do. He sings a number of songs, can say a lot of different things, and he has become very aware of the audience and the fact that the audience is enjoying his performances, and he's kind of a ham at this point.
There's a restaurant in Sheffield that's called The Frog and Parrot. I'm just saying.
Okay. That was a parrot.
Yeah, okay.
I like the rolling
syllable. Totally, I know that's the plumare. I thought that would be the thing that would trip some people up. I did get a lot of guesses, and most of them were like, "It's a bird, it's a bird, it's a bird, it's a bird." Nobody guessed the exact kind because there's a million different kinds, but it is a parrot. Anywho, so Brian Jackson sent in the following noisy. Now, friends of the show, I'm going to warn you again. I don't know why, but this one is a little annoying. It's a little difficult to listen to. It's not going to be like that crunching snow thing or
fingernails on the blackboard.
Oh. It's just a little annoying. You got to stick with me. This is about a 30-second noisy. You got to hear the whole thing. And then, you know, next week it'll be, I promise you, it'll be interesting.
Okay.
So it's a little hard to hear. It's a little.
Alive. It sounded like a bunch of Fisher Price toys for 2 years old.
It's a parrot playing the piano.
I think a lot of people will know what song that is. I'm not looking for the name of the song. I really need the detail. What are we actually hearing? What's making the noise? And there's something very particular about this that if anybody recognizes it, they'll know. So if you think you know what the answer to this week's noisy is, or if you heard anything cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Cool. Thanks, Jay. All right. We got one email this week. Actually, we got a couple. Kara, you're going to respond to some feedback that you got recently.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not going to pick out any particular email. I think there was one kind of major one. I might have gotten one or two others. But this was from a month ago now, 2 months ago, you think?
Just a
couple weeks. Okay. Where we were talking about VR. And you guys were nerding out as usual, like you always do. And somebody called me out for being fat shaming, which made me really sad because it's so not something that I do. But I think that probably I was making a joke, I don't know, that was maybe a bit misconstrued. And I do apologize if anybody felt fat shamed by my comment, because that's definitely not what I meant by it. I think that's sometimes the problem with the cause and effect or correlation. So I was making some sort of joke because you guys were talking about living in a VR headset, and I was making a joke that they would all be XXXL. I wasn't trying to say that obesity leads to being a nerd and being in VR. I was trying to say that if you lived full time in a VR headset and just sat there and ate McDonald's every day, that you would probably need to be XXXL. It was the other way around. So I don't know if that helps. I don't know if that doesn't offend anybody further, but it was sort of Evan, as you mentioned, it was the WALL-E effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, we think,
we talk about that a lot.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, look at the gang on South Park
Exactly.
Oh, with World of Warcraft?
That's what I was referencing. Because we had been talking about...
Oh, my God. No, Jay.
Awesome.
We'd been talking about World of Warcraft. We'd been talking about EverQuest. I was saying how all of my friends in high school, not all of them, but there was a select few friends in high school who legit unplugged from life and just ate ramen noodles 24/7. And it was not a healthy lifestyle, let's put it that way. So definitely I wasn't saying anything about the kinds of people that play VR. I was talking about the effect of losing yourself in a VR world after a long period of time.
Yeah, but with VR, you're standing up and you're moving around. It's a lot better than sitting in a chair and playing on a keyboard.
Really, Steve, you're working out when you play a VR?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have to admit...
You take three
Kara,
steps.
I was doing the archery thing that's in, what is it, the Valve Studio?
Yeah.
And, you could be pretending to shoot arrows using that system for a good half hour, and my upper body got sore from doing that.
Oh, I'm not questioning that there is a chance, just like there was with the Wii, that you could use it for good. I'm saying that's probably not going to be the likely outcome.
I don't disagree. We'll see.
My only point was it's at least better than sitting
Yeah, it's
down.
Not as sedentary. You're right. Yeah, but sitting for a long period of time, standing for a long period of time, they're both not good if you're not
I've
actually
I've already sat too
much.
Long today. I feel bad about
it. I wear 5-pound weights on my wrist when I do the archery game. Then it's a good workout.
Nice.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Lisa Mattresses.
So I got my Lisa mattress, guys.
Nice.
I slept on it for 2 nights.
Straight?
Yeah, I didn't get out of bed for 2 days, right? To give you my honest, I slept on it. The mattress is wonderful. I have chronic shoulder pain in my left hand, in my left side shoulder, because I usually sleep on that side. That's my comfortable side, my go-to side. So I deliberately said, I'm going to sleep on that shoulder and see what it does. And I swear, my shoulder actually is already feeling better, because I think what it's doing is it's balancing the pressure points. You know, it's letting my shoulder kind of sink in and giving me support in other parts of my body. I guess that also means that my other mattress sucks. Legitimately, it really was very comfortable, and it felt like the exact amount of pushback that you want, right? You don't want it to be too soft, and you don't want it to be too firm. I really loved it. I loved it. So I am actually going to order a king size now. The sample that I asked for was not a king size. I'm now going to get a king size.
I love that. And you know what? The truth of the matter is, comfort is key. I think that's the absolute number one. That's what you want in a mattress. But what I really like about Lisa is that they're socially conscious. They donate a mattress to a shelter for every 10 mattresses they sell. And they also plant one tree for every mattress sold. And they donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes.
We want you to try a Lisa mattress in your own home 100 nights risk-free. They are available in the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. This 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door.
Or try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City, and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $100 off when you go to leesa.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, we got a question from Derek Donahue from Seattle, and Derek writes, I'm a huge fan of the show. I finally did some research on my own regarding GMOs and came to some conclusions I'd like you to address on the show. I'm not writing to ask whether GMOs are safe or unsafe. What I'm concerned about is that Monsanto makes a lot of the GMOs, and they have an incentive to use glyphosate on their crops. Studies have shown that GMO crops that started out needing less glyphosate are now needing more of it. The World Health Organization labeled glyphosate as a probable carcinogen. Not to mention glyphosate is the world's number one used pesticide. So, if the only information you are given about a fruit or vegetable is that one is organic and the other is GMO, the safe choice is the former. Any holes in my logic? Thank you guys for all you do, and if you could, please science the hell out of this. Okay. Derek, I'm going to science the hell out of this. Yeah, there's a problem with your premise and your logic. The logic, let me address the logic one first. There's no reason to do the hasty generalization to equate GMOs with herbicide resistance or specifically glyphosate resistant GMOs. It's because GMO is a technology. There's plenty of different types of genetically modified organisms. GMOs, that actually the category, it's arbitrary. But even if you limit it to specific things like transgenic GMOs, where you're taking the gene from a distant species and inserting it into another one, if you decide for some reason that you want to draw the line there, it doesn't matter that at the present time, a lot of GMOs on the market are glyphosate resistant. That's not, there's no reason to equate GMOs with that, because, you know, a GMO could be for some entirely other reason. But the real problem is the underlying factual assumptions or premises here. So first, while it is true that the World Health Organization labeled glyphosate as a probable carcinogen, they were full of shit when they did that, is the bottom line. That the scientist who was on the committee who made that recommendation excluded data from a study that he was involved with that had not yet been published, which showed that there was no correlation between glyphosate use and any cancers. And in any case, this is a really thin connection. There's no connection with people eating food. The only possible connection was with farm workers exposed to glyphosate, and even that connection was dubious. And they had data which showed it's actually not really even a real concern. So that's a red herring. That's a total red herring. In fact, glyphosate is perhaps one of the safest herbicides that are currently being used. It's far safer than the herbicides that it replaced. Further, organic farming uses pesticides, and the pesticides that they use are probably more dangerous than glyphosate or the ones that are used by conventional farming, because the only criterion that a pesticide needs to have to be considered organic is that it is quote unquote natural, which is itself.
It's not synthetic, right?
Yeah, it's an arbitrary category. Not that it's safe, not that it's effective, not that it has evidence that shows that it's safe, just that it's natural. And there are some that are natural that are more toxic than the synthetic alternatives. They often are not as effective either, because when you're essentially prioritizing naturalness and not safety or effectiveness, you're not going to be choosing the most safe or effective options. And they don't, right? So the assumption, the false premise on the organic side is that natural equals safe and effective, but that is patently not true. It is absolutely not true. So they end up picking pesticides that are not as safe and effective as the ones that are being used by those who have free reign to choose the best ones that are out there, including glyphosate. So first of all, you shouldn't be avoiding glyphosate. You certainly shouldn't be avoiding it in favor of other pesticides. And if you want to favor farming that uses no pesticides, then frankly, you are a privileged elitist who doesn't care if half the world starves, because there's absolutely no way we can feed the world without using pesticides, period. Given the fact, multiple facts that we've covered on the show, one, we're already using all the arable land that there is. Organic farming uses, and this is even with pesticides, uses 20% more land. Where's that 20% of land going to come from when we're already using basically all the land that there is available for farming? If you're talking about organic farming without pesticides, it's probably even worse. It's very labor intensive to pull weeds by hand. And if you're using any kind of tilling, that releases a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, which is bad for the environment and bad for the soil. And so there's downsides to every option. When you consider all the options, actually, glyphosate is one of the best that's out there. Now, the only point here that's legitimate, which is not a deal killer for GMOs or for use of glyphosate, is that weeds are starting to become glyphosate resistant. Of course they are. Any method that we use like that, the weeds are going to become resistant. That's why we need to use integrated pest management, right? We need to use a variety of methods that are designed to limit resistance. That's like saying that, oh, well, we shouldn't use antibiotics because people will become antibiotic resistant. You know, the bacteria will become antibiotic resistant. Sure, they will. And we need to take steps to limit antibiotic resistance. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that antibiotics are therefore bad and that we should never use them. We obviously still need to use them. They're better than whatever the alternatives might be in many cases, but we just need to use them smartly to try to minimize resistance. Same is true of any pesticide.
And scientists are even developing these really cool, like, dual gene changes or triple or four because
they're stacking. Yeah.
Yeah. The odds of an organism developing resistance to like three things at the same time is like significantly smaller. And so it'll prevent that from happening nearly as quickly.
Yeah. But see, this is the narrative that the organic food industry wants you to believe. Organic equals no pesticides. GMO equals pesticide. Therefore, avoid GMOs. Buy organic to avoid GMOs, to avoid pesticides. That's their narrative. That's what they want you to believe. And it's bullshit. In fact, there was recently Stonyfield Organic had an ad campaign that was basically
horrible.
Avoid GMOs, eat organic. And they had little girls, you know, parroting these anti-GMO, anti-science talking points, calling GMOs monstrous, bringing up the whole fish mato thing.
Oh, which, that trope.
Oh my God, yeah. That trope. Oh, first of all, there's no GMO tomatoes on the market. No GMO tomatoes are on the market, period.
Yeah. If your tomato's GMO free, yeah, so is everybody else's.
So is everyone else's. the tomato with the fish gene in it was never on the market, and it was perfectly safe.
Oh my gosh.
And all it did was make the tomatoes frost resistant. They didn't have scales or taste like fish or anything else.
Water, get up and swim away.
Frankenfood. But this is the Frankenfood narrative. And they totally went with this, and they're getting a lot of pushback, Stonyfield Organic. Not only that, but then they deleted the science-based criticism that they were getting and called them trolls, even though some of the people who were leaving comments on their website under this ad campaign were scientists. But they just dismissed them. Yeah, all these trolls for Monsanto.
With all their evidence.
Yeah.
Dang it.
So it was a totally foobar ad campaign by Stonyfield Organic. But the thing not to miss is that it made explicit this narrative of buy organic to avoid GMOs because GMOs are monstrous. That's the narrative. And they laid it out there for you. So you can't deny that that's what's going on. And it's just a lie. It's just a lie from beginning to end, really. I mean, the anti-GMO narrative crowd, they got nothing. It's one of those things you really have to look at each individual specific claim, identify a premise, a factual claim, and then do a deep dive on that. Dig down deep. And find out from objective sources and primary sources what's actually going on. And you'll find out that pretty much every talking point on the anti-GMO side is either completely misleading or just straight up fake. It's totally false. So none of it is true. And the whole thing collapses if you do any real investigation. But you got to go deep. You know, you can't just take what the organic lobby is throwing out there, because they're, you know, blanketing with misinformation.
And also, I always say this, and I guess because I've been lucky enough to do this in my career as a science journalist, and I've done it for a lot of outlets, talk to a farmer.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
They are the ones who are making these decisions, and ask them, is somebody forcing you to grow Roundup Ready crops? Why do you choose to grow the crops that you choose? They will tell you hands down, because it works, because I make more money, I can make more food with less rot, with less, you know, disease, all these different things. Like, it works for my farm, and it works for me to put more healthy food on your plate. That's why I do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Farmers get understandably annoyed when either people who are city slickers or have a little organic garden in their backyard or a local farm or something, but they're not like farming on an industrial scale, are telling them how to do their job as if they don't know what's going on, or their rubes being taken advantage of. Yeah.
Like they're victims. Like, Monsanto owns them, and the only reason they buy their seeds is because it's the only choice they have. And it's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, it's all nonsense. Thanks, Derek. I'm always happy to talk about that. Still one of the areas where there's so much misinformation out there. The disconnect between the public and the facts is the greatest. It's the one issue where there's the greatest disconnect between reality and public belief. So we still have our work cut out for us there. All right, guys. Well, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fictitious. We got three regular news items, none of them about extragalactic exoplanets. Are you ready? Carrie, you missed a sweep last week.
You swept everyone? It's because
no,
I wasn't there.
They swept me.
Hey!
Just kidding.
All right, let's get to the damage. Come on.
All right, here we go.
Jay wants to end the pain.
Item number one. Scientists report a process for treating wood that makes it as strong as steel, but six times lighter, and also tough and ballistic resistant. Item number two. A new study finds that knowledge of evolutionary science partly predicts acceptance of evolutionary theory versus creationism. And item number three, medical researchers report that they have effectively cured a case of Duchenne muscular dystrophy with CRISPR-Cas9 gene therapy. Kara, go first.
Okay. Process for treating wood that makes it as strong as steel but six times lighter and tough and ballistic resistant. I don't buy it. We'll see. A new study that finds that knowledge of evolutionary science partly predicts acceptance of evolution. Well, duh. That's going to be the fiction, isn't it? Damn it, Steve. That's so going to be the fiction. It's the most obvious one. The more you learn about evolutionary science, the more likely evolutionary theory becomes. Although I did have a friend when I was getting my master's, she was getting her PhD, who was a young earth creationist getting a PhD in neuroscience.
How does that?
No, my professor was like we would be out sometimes at a bar and like people would be having beer and she would be like, you know, dinosaurs were put in the ground by Jesus. And he would be like, if you talk like that again, I'm going to fail you. Give you your PhD. Yeah. She learned how to tread lightly. Because she was super religious. Medical researchers report that they have effectively cured a case of Duchenne muscular dystrophy with CRISPR-Cas9 gene therapy. That's cool. I don't know enough about muscular dystrophy to know if it's just like one gene problem. If it's like purely heritable, though, and like they know where it is and they know exactly what's wrong with the genetics, I don't see why they couldn't with CRISPR-Cas9. But if it's got like a big environmental effect, or if it's like a bunch of different like epigenetic things, like, or if it's not genetic at all, then that one's the fiction. So it's just predicated on all the stuff I don't know. Great. The wood one seems reasonable, but I'm going to say that that's the fiction because I kind of, If the evolutionary science one partly predicting acceptance of evolutionary theory versus creationism is fiction, I'm going to be annoyed, and I don't even care if I lose because that's freaking annoying and it like throws my entire worldview up into chaos. And the Duchenne muscular dystrophy one, I want to be true. So I'm going to say that the wood one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right, the wood one. That's just too awesome. Wow, that would be so great. I can't think of a reason why it's like insanely not possible. So let's see. The second one here makes sense. So if you are knowledgeable of evolutionary science, that goes partway to predicting that you will accept evolutionary theory instead of creationism. Yeah, I don't have – yeah, right? That makes sense. And I mean, I find that a lot of people who believe in creationism have a completely ass-backwards understanding of evolutionary science. Cas9. I mean, yeah, it's a miracle. The other ones I could buy into. And I could buy into the Cas9 one as well. So I'm going to – I think Steve's just like, oh, they're going to believe this because it's Cas9. It's like anything with nano. Like, sure. So yeah, I'll say Cas9's fiction. What the hell?
Okay, Evan.
Okay, wood as strong as steel, six times lighter? Six times lighter. How is that possible? I think I'm leaning with Kara on this one. Tough and ballistic resistant, I would think so, if it's strong as steel and, you know, can't put bullets through it. I don't know. I think the six times lighter is throwing me off there. The second one about knowledge of evolutionary science partly predicts acceptance of evolutionary theory versus creationism. Perhaps the key here is the word partly predicts. That kind of leaves a nice range of possibilities there as opposed to some kind of absolute. So this one also could certainly be science in that merit. And then the last one about Duchenne muscular dystrophy with CRISPR-Cas9 gene therapy effectively cured. So would like to think that we're talking about a person here, but we might not be talking about a person. This could be like a mouse or rat or something like that, which makes that plausible. They are all entirely sort of plausible, but I don't know. The wood one? I'll go with Bob. I'll say the CRISPR-Cas9 one, muscular dystrophy. Cured a case of it. Yeah, that's fiction.
And Jay.
Yeah, so I mean, there's definitely the one with the wood here. Like, I remember some details about them adding something to wood, and they strip out something and they add something in, like polymers and whatnot. I don't know if it's exactly this. It's the ballistic resilience part of this that makes me question this. But okay, I mean, I could see them doing something to reinforce the wood. I'm sure that they're pulling something out and they're replacing it with something else inside, you know, the wood fibers. Next one here about. If you know about evolutionary science, even a little bit, you're likely to accept it later on down the road. I think that makes sense, and I would think that there might have something to do here. Like when they say if you knew about it previously, it might mean that you may have received some education about it at a younger age, which would make you more, you know, understanding of it. But I could see that. You know, it seems to make sense. And everybody knows I'm a big fan of CRISPR. I truly believe that between VR and CRISPR, you know, this is the only thing that's going to save humanity. So I am going to say that this one is the fiction just on the fact that I don't think we're close to doing this level of curing with CRISPR yet. I don't think we're there yet. This is going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet. I'm going with Bob, 72% likelihood that we are going to be correct.
Wait, I'm okay. On my own?
You're on your own, Kara.
Crap.
But that means you all agree with number two, so we'll start there. A new study finds that knowledge of evolutionary science partly predicts acceptance of evolutionary theory versus creationism. You all think this one is science. Now, of course, the question here is how much does political affiliation and religiosity predict acceptance of evolution versus creation.
Doesn't matter because it only has to partly predict it based on the way you worded it.
Is there anything left? Does it matter? Does it matter how much people know about evolutionary theory?
I think so.
Will their politics or religion override that?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, this one is science.
Gee whiz.
Now, I was very careful in how I stated this, however. So technically, you know, they basically took people and they measured their acceptance of evolution versus creation on a range of, you know, statements. They tried to be more nuanced in their assessment of it. And then they also asked them questions to challenge their understanding of evolutionary theory. And there was this correlation between knowledge of evolution and acceptance of evolution. So it wasn't all predicted by politics and religion, although those were dominant factors. But the headlines I disagreed with. They said that understanding evolution makes you accept it. And this study isn't capable of concluding that. This showed only a correlation.
Yeah.
I think it's far more likely in fact, that if you believe in evolution, you're going to understand it better rather than the other way around. You know what I mean? Because I agree with Bob. My experience is that creationists learn about evolution from hostile secondary sources that teach them wrong. They basically, yeah. they get misinformed about evolution because they are in the creationist echo chamber.
But if you learn about evolution in a really, I think, supportive classical education way, it hopefully will make you at least bring that knowledge into your worldview. Whether or not you change your mind is
different.
It'd
be nice, but this study wasn't capable mm-hmm. of showing that. We need to do some follow-up tests to see, you know, you need to show some cause and effect, you know, give some people an understanding of evolution and then check them later and see if that had an effect on
yeah,
their
you do.
Ability.
But the truth of the matter is, like what Bob said is true. Like most people who believe or who don't believe in evolution don't understand.
Yeah.
They strawman it.
Yeah, they strawman it, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because they're listening to creationist sources.
Mm-hmm.
They're just echoing those talking points, and they're wrong. It's like talking to the organic lobby about GMOs. You're not going to be well informed. Okay, so let's go back to number one. Scientists report a process for treating wood that makes it as strong as steel, but 6 times lighter and also tough and ballistic resistant. Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. Mm-hmm. And this one is... Science.
Crap.
Oh boy. Bob, did you read this one?
I read it 45 minutes ago, and I almost sent all of you a link. And I was like, no, Steve might actually have this for Science of Fiction. This
That's
is such
hilarious.
An awesome story. I was going to cover it on the next week's show, but now I might not be able to because Steve doesn't let me cover crap that we had in Science of Fiction.
That's correct. So we're going to talk about it right now because it's very interesting. So what they did, this is compressed wood. So they take wood, you know, whatever, just natural wood. They treat it with chemicals, mainly to remove the lignin, which is one of the organic compounds in the wood. And then they compress it. And then they heat it in another process. When they do that, you form a lot of hydrogen bonds between the collagen that's left behind in the wood. And all of those bonds between the strands of collagen make it super strong. And they also keep it from re-expanding. So you end up with this dense compressed wood, this densified wood, as they call it. And that's super strong. It's a strong, some say stronger than steel. I guess it depends on what kind of steel. Some say as strong as steel, maybe even as strong as titanium steel alloys, some are saying. And it's ballistic resistant. You know, the bullets will embed themselves in the wood, but they won't go through.
Incredible, man.
Yeah.
Strong and tough.
So
it's hard to have those both in the same material.
Right.
And light.
It resists being bent and also being broken, you know, so it doesn't fracture, but it also holds its shape. It's got like tensile strength and resistance.
You can see this in cars. You can see this in cars and structural, you know, in critical elements of your car.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine your – yes?
You are such a material science nerd.
I do. I love it.
I love it so much. It's so – the difference between you and me, among many, is that I would never stop and read this article.
Oh, my God.
I would just be like, oh, God.
Are you crazy? The article says new process makes wood 10 times stronger. I leaped into that damn article.
Yeah, and I'm just like, sure, okay, whatever. Like,
now, Carrie, you're missing the boat, man. Material science is where it's at. Seriously.
Oh, I know. Really. I get it. It's really cool.
The material science is what changes the rules of the game, right? Yeah. Now we could start making stuff out of densified wood. Yeah, that new stuff that has cool properties. You can shape it, you know, and as part of the process, you could put it into whatever shape you want. It's, you know, stronger steel, lighter. You could, you know, think of all the stuff you could make out of this, what this could do to, you could build bridges out of it.
This is why I am really glad. I'm just endlessly grateful for the fact that it takes all kinds of people to make the world go round.
Gosh, right? Please.
Yes, because other people do so much cool stuff that I would never do.
All right. All of this means that medical researchers report that they have effectively cured a case of Duchenne muscular dystrophy with CRISPR-Cas9. Gene therapy is the fiction. Mm. Now, they did make a breakthrough, but they didn't cure a human with it, which is what I was actually implying.
But you did not write human.
I know. They didn't cure anybody with it.
Oh, okay.
What they did was they took heart muscle.
Technicality.
They took heart muscle that heart from muscle. with the Duchenne mutation, and then they treated it with Cas9, and then the heart muscle was able to take on a more normal structure and function.
They cured the tissue.
Yeah, so it was just a tissue test. But what?
So wait, that doesn't count as curing a case of muscular dystrophy?
It's not a case. It's just cells.
Whatever. I feel like that is a very nuanced difference.
It's good. But they haven't done human trials. That's the thing. And those are coming. But what's really interesting about this, you know, this one's one I could have used as the science or as the fiction, depending on how I said it, that they found a location in the gene, the mutated gene for Duchenne, that when they splice that out, it actually fixes over 300 different Duchenne mutations.
Wow.
It is way more than just one little genetic tweak.
Well, it's all in the same gene, right?
That's cool.
So,
okay.
Yeah. Essentially,
one gene can manifest itself in many different variants of Duchenne's.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
Well, so there's one gene codes for one muscle protein, right? And if you have a certain kind of mutation that basically renders it non-functional, you get Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. If you have another kind of mutation that impairs it but doesn't completely render it useless, you have Becker's muscular dystrophy, which is not as bad. It runs the full gamut. You know, it's like, so Duchenne's is like the 100% deficit, and Becker's is everything from 1 to 99% deficit, depending on the mutation. But Duchenne's is the worst one. But it doesn't have to be one specific mutation. It's any mutation that completely borks the protein, right? But what they
is
were
that
saying,
a technical term, borking the protein?
So what they found was that there's this critical area, and if they could control for most of the Duchenne mutations by just splicing out this one bad location that where all the mutations are happening. So that's good because you don't have to design a CRISPR treatment for all 300 different mutations. It's one size fits all, you know. So hopefully by later this year they'll get FDA approval for human trials. And so this may be a treatment in a few years, you know. This may be a cure for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. This was just the basic science that shows that it's plausible.
Right. Yeah. Good preliminary step. So I think your problem with this last one, and I agree, is the use of the word case. Because that, to me,
the fact that he said effectively cured, which means for all intents and purposes, Duchenne's was reversed in something or someone. Which in this case, it was.
Yeah, for me though, it's the word case
implies
like a living thing, not
just tissue.
Well, right.
I'm sorry. It's actually 3,000 mutations, not 300. I misremembered.
Oh, yeah,
3,000.
Wow, that's huge.
Impressive.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I think a lab heart counts as a case, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. All right, what ifs?
But it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. So good job, everyone. Kara, this is a tricky one.
And material science ain't your thing.
Kara is not happy. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right, this quote this week comes from listener Adrian Sheridan from California. Thanks, Adrian. I like this quote. I've learned that most problems aren't rocket science, but when they are rocket science, you should ask a rocket scientist. In other words, I don't know everything, so I've learned to seek advice and counsel and listen to experts. And that was written by Scott Kelly, astronaut Scott Kelly, from his book titled Endurance, and talking about his experience in space. And he put that in as one of his closing thoughts for the book.
Yeah, it's cool. That's a skeptical thought. Good for him.
It is. And we do love Scott Kelly as we love all of our NASA astronauts. They are wonderful.
And you could certainly see why an astronaut would be keen to trust a rocket scientist.
Right. Of course. It's part of the job, Steve.
Yeah. He doesn't want those non-rocket scientists meddling around with his rocket. You know what I mean?
This isn't rocket science. It's brain surgery.
Also, some astronauts are rocket scientists, so there's that.
That's true. But it is funny that with certain things, like there are no alternative brain surgeons, right?
Right.
I mean, there's certain, you're going to have somebody do certain things. You're not gonna. There's no alternative to somebody who actually knows what they're talking about.
I don't know, but Steve, would you be surprised? I wouldn't be surprised.
psychic.
Well, the psychic surgery would probably be the closest.
Yeah,
the
only
man, that's just you know.
There's psychic surgery, but still, like, if you're going to go under the knife and someone's going to use the alternative surgical techniques or whatever, or is not classically trained in neurosurgery, you know, if you basically substitute all the justifications that people use to justify like not being a real doctor but being a fake doctor. Okay, you might take nutrition advice to them, but you're not going to let them open up your skull, right?
Yeah.
Same thing is you're not going to get in a rocket where the people working on it were not actual scientists who know what the hell they're talking about.
Of course not.
Like, you'll notice there are no alternative preventive treatments for pregnancy, right?
Well, there are. They just don't work.
Well, the point is they, condoms?
Whether or not they work is so immediate and obvious that they just don't proliferate, right? The outcome has to be vague and uncertain. When there's immediate and clear-cut outcomes like pregnancy, there's not a big market for alternative of pregnancy treatments.
Yeah, and the alternative stuff honestly only works for people, quote-unquote, never works, but they only use it until it doesn't work anymore. Like, I've known plenty of people who had, like, a UTI or a yeast infection, and they use, like, alternative, quote-unquote, treatments until they're, like, in so much pain that they're like, I need meds.
Yeah, right.
That's common. Yeah. Think about all the women who want to have natural pregnancies until they're like, nope, not doing that anymore.
Right. Or if it's a self-limiting thing, they'll use different treatments until it goes away. And then whatever they took last, that's what gets the credit for it.
Right.
Even if they also took real treatment, which never gets the credit. It's only the last fake thing they took. That's what did it.
It was that honey tea I had that did it.
That's right. It wasn't the antibiotics.
Right. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
Thanks again for joining me. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.